All right. I'd like to welcome everyone to another edition of our Tax Town Hall. We are coming to you this Wednesday with heavy hearts. We do not have our co-host Gary Thomason with us. For those of you who did not hear through the grapevine, Gary passed away. I forget the date. Larry, was it the 9th or?
Yeah.
He passed away on November 9th. And so we thought what we'd do is at least, you know, give our reflections on our time with Gary. Perhaps if there's any in the audience who did later on in the show, if we have a chance, or, you know, basically go ahead and chat if you'd like to make any comment about Gary. Anyway, let's go ahead and do our prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen.
Amen.
So we're
why don't you classically say, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and glory? Why don't y'all say that? That's the way it ends, the Lord's Prayer.
Well, I guess it depends if you're looking at Luke or Matthew, for one thing, but also that's just something, I guess, between the Catholics and the Protestants as to whether that's in the original scripture. There's something called the Didache with the apostles, that where that appears. And so anyway, I mean, the reason that Catholics don't put that at the end is because, it according to Catholic tradition, it wasn't in the original scripture, but it was in some of the early early apostles' writings. Also in Luke versus Matthew, that isn't there, even as I'm pretty sure in the St. James, in the
King James.
James Bible. So anyway, that's my position, but we could alternate, or if it, you know.
That was just a question that passed through my mind.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, we do certainly wish the best to our friend Gary in terms of the repose of his soul, and that he, as expediently as possible, is seeing that place that we all hope to end up in someday. But anyway, Larry, you knew Gary probably the best, or at least interacted with him the most. So, you know, could you say a few words about your personal interactions?
The first time I met Gary, you know, I was representing Tommy Crier, got indicted in 2007 in Shreveport, Louisiana. He was his lawyer that was charged with tax crimes. And one day, it seems like it was the fall of 2007, you know, I drove over. We were getting ready to do something on Tommy's case. It was kind of in the beginning days of his case. And, you know, Tommy smoked and I smoked back in those days. And we were outside. Gloria wouldn't let Tommy smoke in the office, so we always had to step out. And we stepped out one time, and, you know, I was happened to be out there in a suit. I think we may have been to court that day. But suddenly this guy pulls up in an old, you know, Cheech and Chong vehicle, parks in front and hops out, and he's got on shorts and everything else. Hey, I'm Gary Thomason. And he was from Shreveport, although he was at the time living out in LA, and he had heard about Tommy's case, and, you know, he came to help. And he was just that much interested in joining in the battle and learning how it's fought. You know, he knew something about tax issues, but he didn't know anything about going into the court and everything else like that. But he was very helpful. You know, he greatly assisted in Tommy's trial. We did a lot of, you know, I had to travel back and forth from Huntsville to Shreveport a lot. But somebody had to kind of guard over Tommy and, you know, crack the whip and make him do stuff. You know, you got to work on your testimony. You got to pull the documents together. And I can remember the Sunday before trial, you know, Mondays are typical trial days. That's where you start the trial. And I got over there that Sunday afternoon. I didn't have to come over early because Gary was working on Tommy's testimony. And, you know, Tommy put a lot of time and effort into his testimony. And Gary was there to help him all the way. One of the things that we wanted to do when Tommy's trial started off is, you know, there was this effort. We were going to try to influence the jury. And Tommy had a whole bunch of signs printed up that we were going to drive all over Shreveport and, you know, put them out on the highway. Hey, Tommy Cryer, not guilty of tax crimes, you know. You know, we were going on the offense. That's the way Tommy wanted to do it. But, you know, that starts my relationship with Gary. You know, Gary turned out to be a fantastic guy. On a number of criminal cases that I had, I saw what Gary could do with, you know, sitting down with people and talking to them and just walking them through. You know, that's what you have to do when you're working with a client, trying to get them to build their testimony. It's you got to lord over them. You can't just say, build your timeline, work on your testimony. You got to sit there and crack that whip. That's the only, you know, if you don't do that, they're not going to do it. And, you know, Gary was good because he had the time to sit down with a lot of these folks and work on their testimony. We had a number of cases together. You know, I would have Gary be my paralegal for, we had one case out in Hawaii one time, Lucky Bennett, Texas, you know, several other cases where Gary, you know, I could call him up and he would have the time and he would go to the client and work on their testimony. And he'd be there through trial. He'd watch the trial. So, you know, that's what Gary did. He and I worked a lot on a lot of cases together. I would provide him with educational materials, you know, learning, you know, all the tax acts, the regulations, the statutes of large and stuff like that. He really got off into that, you know, not that he didn't have about, you know, 15 or 20 years of looking into the tax issues before I met him. He had, but you know, now that he met me and I had, you know, a lot of that foundational stuff put together, you know, that greatly helped him. So, you know, he ended up in the last, you know, 7 and 8 and 10 years, you know, just working with people, helping them with their problems regarding the tax. He was a good writer. You know, he would sit down. You know, sometimes he would just stay up all night, you know, working on something. A lot of times when I'd call him, you know, you couldn't wake him up because he's asleep during the middle of the day. And, you know, he'd wake up in the afternoon and that's when he'd begin to move around. But, you know, Gary was a real good, he was a good friend of mine. And he was a real patriot, and I will sorely miss him. Well, now that we've had our condolences with Gary, shall we get around to some meat?
Just wondering, does Sean any impressions?
Well, I never met Gary personally. I have many telephone calls with him and communicate in various ways. Plus, we plan shows together, these shows together. And so in that respect, I worked with him. I found him to be a very affable person, very easy to get along with, very knowledgeable. And as Larry said, he's going to be sorely missed in this movement. We're losing too many people, and we lost a very important piece this time around.
Yeah, my quick impression is just I thought that I had seen a lot of evidence that the IRS is applying the, you know, day-to-day income tax, administering and enforcing outside of the laws and regulations. Then when I met Gary, it went to a whole new level in terms of what he was able to, you know, dig through and you know, point out. And so he just was amazing. And as Larry pointed out, you know, he's so dedicated. He wasn't just taking care of himself. He was taking care of all of us. And he really cared about his friends. He cared about his fellow Americans. He cared about the country. He cared about the generations who were really close to probably losing or having the tiniest little remnant to even carry forward these truths about the income tax. So just really a guy that cared and cared about his fellow man. So of course that's a Christian principle that we are obliged to adhere to, and he certainly did have a lot of you know, care for his fellow man. So I'm going to miss them tremendously. Even tonight, I was just like, okay, well, I always gather, you know, the websites and the host information. And I just like, wow, I can't, you know, Gary's not with us anymore. So anyway, we just are going to miss him. And we're grateful that he participated. You know, a lot of those archives of those linked on my website feature Gary. So go back there and go down memory lane and see, you know, how dedicated he was to the movement and to our show. So with that, Larry, go right ahead with the topic for tonight.
Well, Joe, I thought it would be, before we get into kind of the meat of what we're talking about, I'd like to mention that what we're seeing right now on TV, this spectacle, this impeachment inquiry, you know, where you have all these questions that are asked of witnesses, you know, I would like to comment about how educational the impeachment inquiry is, especially when you're making a comparison with a proceeding in court where evidence is going to be submitted, and this comedy show that we're seeing brought to us by the crackpot Democrats. Can I make a few comments about that?
Please do.
You know, there's the rules of evidence, and the rules of evidence, there's just some major big principles that relate to evidence. And those are things that are developed over time. Now, if you go back a couple of hundred years to where we had no real established rules of evidence, you know, you would see a proceeding like what we are watching on TV now. What you see on TV, you have the examiner, the man that's asking the questions, he is providing the testimony. The witnesses are just simply sitting there, oh yeah, I guess so, you know. And it's something that we all know. That isn't the way evidence is. You don't prove a fact like that. You call a witness that has personal knowledge to get him to establish a fact. Now, the Democrats, they sit there and say, well, you heard this, didn't you? Well, yeah, we've all heard all sorts of things. And because we've heard it, it's evidence. In a court of law, that isn't proof. That isn't evidence. That's excluded as, you know, we call it hearsay. And I call hearsay, if you want to convert hearsay to something that's colloquial, call it rumors. And, you know, hearsay is colloquially rumors. But that's exactly what we see is going on, you know, throughout this proceeding. We don't have anybody that has personal knowledge. All they're talking about is, I heard that there was a quid pro quo. Well, did you talk to the president? Oh, yeah, I talked to the president. He said there was no quid pro quo. That's what we heard today. And yet, the testimony that the Democrats want to elicit is all this hearsay that there was this quid pro quo. And the lawyers, the congressmen that are asking the questions, most of them is kind of like, you know, y'all saw that interesting videotape of Eric Swalwell here in the last couple of days. He was on TV.
Which one?
Oh, Eric Swalwell. Oh, he's being interviewed, I think, on CNN. And a little gas passes. Have you all seen that one?
Missed that one.
I mean, it's on the internet. Swalwell.
Isn't that hearsay too?
No. Well, no. That was, you could plainly see. Yeah. It would be hearsay if I, you know, were to tell you about the contents of a video. But you know, somebody that took that video, you could be called into court to authenticate. Yes, this is, I was standing there and this is the video I caught of that. And that tape would be admissible in court by that fashion, but it wouldn't be admissible if I attempted to do that. But you know, that's, you get to see here some real reasons why we have rules of evidence. You know, the testimony comes from the witnesses and not the lawyer or the party, the examiner. And that's what we're seeing in court today.
Well,
and
Larry, we're seeing
the hearsay's evidence. And in fact, there was a Democrat congressman that sits there and tried to justify. He said hearsay is perhaps better than direct evidence. I couldn't believe that. Unbelievable. But that's my lesson for tonight about, you know, a recent example here in American society about the reasons why we have rules of evidence.
Yeah, I've got two comments, Larry. I watched that senator do that. I about dropped down laughing dead.
Yeah.
That goes to show you what these lawmakers, that's what these lawmakers know about the law. But one comment on those attorneys, both of them, both sides. I think out of all the times I heard those attorneys talking, I think maybe they asked two questions that the witness could explain as opposed to a leading question. Here's a scenario. Here's what happened. Right?
Yeah.
And yeah. So, that sounds really good.
Yeah. They're being led. They're like horses. They've got their bridles on and they are being led straight.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
So that's what I wanted to comment about, you know, using a current example, what we're seeing on the boob tube, and the reasons why we got rules of evidence. So the rules of evidence are not all that difficult. They, you know, there's a lot of details to them, but you know, you got to have personal knowledge and you can't testify about hearsay. And, you know, there's ways to authenticate things, but the rules of evidence aren't all that difficult, but you get to see them slaughtered when the Democrats are doing it. But then when the, you know, Republicans get up there, you know, the Republicans get straight to do you have any personal knowledge?
Right.
You know, did the president say that to you? No. I'm just presuming it, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's being taken as evidence. What a farce. Yep. That's all I would like to say about the...
Where do you think it's going to go, Larry? You have any predictions?
Well, I've been getting up in the morning, you know, I watch Fox, and they've got pretty good coverage. So I've been drinking a couple of cups of coffee in the morning before I head down to the office to watch some of the proceedings. I want to see, you know, Adam. I'd like to pronounce his last name in a different way, but it would be X-rated. You know, shifty. You know, I watch him and I watch the opening statements of something. It's just incredible. You get to see that in the morning, all these witnesses, you know, the summaries by Schiff and the summaries by Devin Nunes, and then the summary by the witness. And, you know, you can get a pretty good taste about what the witness is going to say, but all the Democrats come forward is with hearsay. And then you'll have somebody like Nunes or somebody else, Ratcliffe or somebody, come along and do you have any direct knowledge? No. It's all rumor and hearsay that there's a quid pro quo. So it's a real... If people are following it, they get to have a good shot at the reason why we have rules of evidence. Because rules of evidence are just time-tested. You know, we've learned long ago that, you know, rumors prove nothing. You don't want to call a witness to come to court to testify about a rumor. A rumor's inadmissible. You want somebody to come to court that has personal, firsthand knowledge. That's the way you prove it. Yeah, I was standing there as he pulled out the gun and shot that guy. That's a real witness. And a witness isn't. Yeah, you know, this guy that was standing there and watched all that, he told me about it. That is rumor and hearsay. And these are the reasons why we have rules of evidence. That's all I have to say, Joe. I think we ought to probably get into, you know, I've got 8:24 my time. And we spent 24 minutes, and I think we've got some things to cover that we want to educate our listeners to, our attendees about tonight.
Yeah, okay. Well, I have that document. Do you want me to share it?
Well, you know, Sean wanted to talk about direct taxes, and both of us agreed we would talk about direct taxes. I think it's real important. You know, one of the things is, you know, here we are in the debate, the presidential running season. You know, we got all these demos up there. And one of them is Elizabeth Warren, and she has this tax she wants to impose, a wealth tax. And, you know, just like we've been talking in some of the previous shows, about equal protection. You know, these are, you know, I think in a previous show we were talking about, or I at least explained, you know, a legal principle, a constitutional principle regarding equal protection, that it, once you learn the principle, then you can see the flaw of national health care. You can see the flaw of all these gun proposals. And if you learn something a little bit about direct and indirect taxes, then you can see when somebody like Elizabeth Warren gets up there, you can see that what she's proposing, the way of a wealth tax, is unconstitutional.
Great. Well, Sean, you want to jump in? Do you need that document that Larry had, or are you just going to go without it?
No, I'm good with what I have.
Okay.
First off, I'd like to explain to the audience, the reason we're doing this is for you folks that have been around for a while, consider it a refresher course. I think we forget a lot of times just exactly where the genesis for everything that is going on in the world of taxation comes from when it comes to the federal government. Also for the new folks that are just joining us, whether they've heard this before or not, it's important to understand the powers of taxation the federal government has. Then we have, for the record, we have recordings that Joe is good enough to get posted on the internet, and people that never watch these live webinars will pick up on these recordings, and they may have never heard something like this before. That's another reason I'm doing this tonight. And for the people that have come for the first time and said, you know what, I'm curious about this income tax and I want to find out something about it. So this is for them probably more than anyone else. So anyway, the federal government, you know, as Larry was saying, when you listen to these Democrats talk about what they're going to do with health care and what they're going to do with providing everybody $1,000 a month stipend, that's nice, isn't it? Where is this money going to come from? It's going to come from taxes. When you listen to these folks, you think that the government has an unlimited, unfettered power of taxation at their hands, at their disposal, they can use at any time, in any manner, for any purpose they want. That's what they think. It's not true. The United States Constitution has provided two powers of taxation to the federal government. One's called direct taxation. One is called the indirect method of taxation. I'm going to cover the direct method of taxation first. If you go to the United States Constitution, you're going to find under Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, this phrase. Representative in direct taxes, now they use the word direct taxes, shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers. I'll explain that in a minute. Our founding fathers thought this was a very important phrase, so they didn't put it in the Constitution once, they put it in the Constitution twice. In Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, you will find the following language. No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. This is simple, the way this works. But before I get into this, I want to advise you that Jefferson had a lot to say about taxation. He talked a little bit about direct taxation and indirect taxation. And when he discussed direct taxation, he noted that a direct tax is something that would rarely be levied by the United States government for a couple of reasons. First off, he reasoned it would be difficult to collect under the rules of direct taxation set forth in the Constitution. Second, he believed that there would be no need for direct taxes to run the legitimate functions of the government, and that the imposition of one would be rare, and it would be needed only in the time of an emergency or war. That was Jefferson's reason. He was one of the most intelligent men that was sitting with our founding fathers, by the way. So here's how direct taxation works. The House of Representatives sits down and they draft up a revenue bill, and they take a look at all the taxes they can collect through the indirect method of taxation. And they look down and say, you know what, and this is, by the way, just an example. They sit down, especially in today's dollars, they sit down and take a look at their shortfall. They say, well, you know, we're going to raise so many taxes by our imposts and our duties and our excises. We're going to have $1 million shortfall. We have to impose a direct tax. So they write up their revenue bill and they decide $1 million in addition is needed. And they levy this direct tax. They don't send this direct tax bill to you. They send it to the state government of each state. And what they do, how they determine the amount that's going to be collected from each state, is simply by the number of people that live in the state. This is what they mean by apportionment among the several states. For example, if California has 10% of the population in the United States at the time the direct tax is levied, 10% of the $1 million tax bill that Congress has authorized has to be paid by the state of California. South Dakota, if it only has 1% of the population, it has to pay 1% of that direct tax bill to the federal government. And it's apportioned among the several states in that manner according to their population. The Founding Fathers thought that was a fair way based upon the amount of representatives in the state and the ability of the people in the state to pay the tax. So this state or this direct tax is then sent to the governor of the state, whatever state it's sent to. He sits down and he looks at it and he says, okay, we have to collect X amount of dollars from the citizens of this state. This is how we're going to do it. And the state officials go out and say, okay, guys, you're going to have to pony up. The federal government needs money. We're here to collect it as a state tax bill. When we get it, we'll send it to the federal government. So the state officials would go around and they would collect this direct tax levy by the federal government. You never saw a federal agent. You didn't even know these federal agents, tax agents existed. It wasn't up to them to collect it. This was a state function job. So they would go around and they would collect it from the citizens, and there would be no federal interaction with the citizens. The governor would collect the money. He'd send it off to the state or to the federal government, and hopefully he'd ask for a receipt, knowing what things are going on today. And everybody would be happy. Well, maybe not the citizens because they didn't want to pay the tax, but that's the way the direct tax method functioned. There was another thing. In addition to this method of collecting a direct tax, when the governor sat down and they looked at this tax bill that the House and Senate passed and the president put his name to, they could sit down prior to the 17th Amendment and say, you know, I don't know what's going on in Washington, but I know one thing, I don't like it. And now they're sitting here and they're trying to collect direct taxes from us for additional money in addition to their normal indirect excise taxes. You know what? Recall those senators, get their butts here, get them back home. They're going to answer to this state legislature and they're going to answer to me. That was the whole idea about the senators being appointed and elected by the appointed by the state legislature and the governor of each state, as opposed to popular election. Those senators were representing the state, and when the state, in other words, the government of the state, did not like what the senators were doing, they could recall them, and this is one way they could control their senators. The 17th Amendment took that problem away from the state. Actually, it wasn't a problem. They took that privilege or that right away from the states. That's another issue we'll have to get into. Anyway, that's the sum and substance of a direct tax and the imposition and the way it works. Now, keep in mind that that tax is subject to the rule of apportionment. It has to be apportioned among the several states according to the number of people residing within that state. There are no exceptions. The Supreme Court has ruled on this over and over again. I know there's an outlier case. I'm not sure. I don't recall the name right offhand, Larry. Maybe you do. But there's an outlier case that says, well, the income tax is this special, unique, direct tax that doesn't require apportionment. But that's an outlier. That's not what the Supreme Court has said over and over and over again, and starts with Grushaber, when Grushaber attacked it, or even Pollock. And the questions were, was it a direct tax or an indirect tax? Did it have to be apportioned? Was it subject to uniformity? And those cases we've discussed before. And folks, I encourage you to look up both Pollock and the Grushaber cases and study them. They're long. They're not easy reading, but it'll give you some foresight as to how the Supreme Court looked at, or insight as to how the Supreme Court looked into this. Excuse me. So when it comes to the United States government, we've asked, or I have asked, and I've had members ask, well, if it's direct tax, how does the government explain this apportionment, that it has to be apportioned among the several states? And actually, very few times will the government anymore say that it's a direct tax. They'll even claim it's an indirect tax, or many governments will, state governments and federal government will claim it's an indirect tax. But as far as being a direct tax, they pretty much, I think, disclaim that it's a direct tax. Rather, they say it's an indirect tax. Well, that's kind of hard to fathom, because a direct tax is a tax that's laid directly on you. You have to pay it. You can't escape it. You can't shove it off onto someone else like a retailer does at a store and have the customer pay. When they come looking for it, they're going to be looking for you, and you're the one that has to open your wallet. That's how direct taxes work. Now, with that in mind, let's go to the power of indirect taxes. You can find that under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution. And it reads, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. You have